Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned into 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and often interrupt our daily lives. Allow me to introduce a new addition to 411 Teen lineup, the Inner Beat. Inner Beat addresses conditions and issues related to development, mental health, and wellness in the youthful population. The FSU Center for Autism and Related Disorders is the first collaboration in this step. Over the next 4 months, 411 Teen will explore autism spectrum disorder, a developmental disability caused by differences in the brain. It's a complex range of conditions that are composed of very different features and symptoms. Often, they are difficult to understand for families and professionals. FSU CARD, Center for Autism Related Disorders, joins 411 Teen to present this four-part series on autism and related disorders. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Welcome the first edition of Inner Beat, Autism Spectrum Disorders, ASD. Joining me via the Zoom platform, I welcome Dr. Amy Weatherby, Director of FSU Autism Institute, Distinguished Research Professor, Department of Clinical Sciences, College of Medicine.
Thanks, it's great to be here with you.
Glad to have you. Catherine Zinko, MS, Director, Center for Autism Related Disabilities, FSU.
Hey, thank you so much, Liz, for having us on the show.
Yeah, glad to have you. First, let's talk about CARD, because I know when I say FSU CARD, folks are probably like, what is she talking about? So will you all share with us just what CARD is, the Center for Autism and Related Disorders? What is it? And whoever wants to, you know, respond to that question is fine.
Okay, Liz, I'll take it. It's the Center for Autism and Related Disabilities. Oftentimes we do get confused with the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, but that is actually a intervention agency. So it's very common to get mixed up. But the Center for Autism and Related Disabilities, which is what CARD stands for here in Florida, is a state-funded program. We have been in the Florida state statute for over 31 years. And the state of Florida had some really amazing intuition that said, we want to provide regional autism centers mm-hmm. for Floridians who are on the autism spectrum. The FSU CARD is one of seven CARD centers that are throughout the state of Florida. And our center up here at FSU covers 18 counties of the Big Bend and Panhandle area. So we have a very large geographic region that we cover. Mm-hmm. But all of the CARD centers provide the same services to our Floridians. It's a lifetime organization where we serve anybody from as early as they are suspected of having a diagnosis of autism as a toddler all the way through adulthood. All of the services are at no charge to individuals who live in Florida. We work with individuals and their families who have autism throughout their lifespan to provide short-term consultation, perhaps on some issues that they're having. So an example of something that we work with families of young children oftentimes might be struggling with potty training. So we might mm-hmm. give them some information, do some consultation, share some ideas. Through school age, we work both with families and schools all around the area, public, private, charter, any school. And working with the educators who are teaching the student on the spectrum, what are some best practices? How can we make the education most relevant to the student and put it in a way that they get the most out of their education. We also provide training to anybody in our community that, you know, obviously with schools, but businesses, faith-based organizations, libraries, airports. So we provide training. We do public awareness, which is a huge push. You will hear now that we are coming into April, which is Autism Awareness and Acceptance Month. So spreading the news about what is autism, what is CARD, what is the process, how can you get services? And then, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask, how do you interface with the Autism Institute, and what is that a distinct difference?
Yes, okay. I will start and then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Weatherby, but CAR, the FSU Center for Autism and Related Disabilities, falls under the much larger umbrella that is FSU's Autism Institute, which is a department in the College of Medicine. Amy?
Yeah, so we formed the Autism Institute about 18 years ago. CARD predates that. First, we had CARD, and the Autism Institute is in the College of Medicine at Florida State University, and we have many different projects. Some of them are research projects, which are funded by national agencies like the National Institutes of Health, U.S. Department of Education. And then we also have service projects like Autism Navigator and Baby Navigator, which provide information to the public. Our audience is global. So we have everything that we do with the navigators is online. And so we have a global audience, whereas CARD is regional. Okay. We have boundaries, but we are part of this statewide network.
I have a kid. How do I connect with you all? What is, that would be with CARD, I guess.
What's the process, or either one?
What's the process?
Well, it depends where you live.
Okay. Yep.
So I get emails daily. I'm sure Kathy does as well. And then we get messages. And so the first question is, where do you live? If the families live in our catchment area in the Panhandle, then I refer to CARD. And CARD gets their own direct referrals from either families or professionals. So families can reach out. And we have a lot of information on our CARD website. Kathy, I'll let you talk about that.
Absolutely. So our CARD website is very easy. It is just fsucard.com. It oftentimes, if people are searching, they might come up with the ID card that Florida State University uses. But if you type in fsucard.com, you will get right to the Center for Autism here at FSU, our website. People who are looking to connect with us, we have one section on our website that's called Frequently Asked Questions, which will answer pretty much what it says, your most frequent questions. We also have the ability for you to fill out an intake to become a client right off our website. So we do that online to try and streamline and make sure that we capture everybody who is asking for help.
Do you do evaluations, and what's the process for that? My kid's having some problems. I'm not quite sure what is happening and where they're going. And even the pediatrician doesn't seem to know.
I'll start with a quick, and then I'm going to turn to Amy. CARD does not do evaluations.
Okay.
As I mentioned earlier, we were put into Florida statute over 31 years ago. And in that statute, it says we are not allowed to do diagnosis. So we're kind of the after the diagnosis.
Okay.
Amy's team has some availability. Amy, do you want to explain?
Yeah, but also CARD provides resources for families or other professionals in their community. So they're able to direct them to professionals who make a diagnosis.
Yes, thank you.
So they're a really good resource, referral, on where to go to get a diagnosis. So at the Institute, the only diagnoses that we do are for families and individuals who have been in our research study. So we have research funding, and we are able to provide diagnoses to families if they're within one of our research protocols. And that would be for free as well to families, which is nice. But it's a limited, you know, our research has a limited range. The biggest audience that we are geared to in the Autism Institute is to get really young children diagnosed earlier. So we have Baby Navigator, And we have funding from the National Institutes of Health to do both early identification as well as early intervention to fund that. So the path in is through Baby Navigator, but that's where families can go, babynavigator.com. But their child must be 18 months of age or younger. So it's for the real young end. We have another service project called Autism Navigator, which really is the parent project, which has a lot of training material on early detection, as well as early intervention, as well as classroom intervention and other topics related to autism that we have developed with funding from the state of Florida. And we have courses and resources for families, for professionals, both in early intervention and school or other professionals across. Most of our work is for 1 to 8 years of age, but we're trying to expand older. And so you can go to our website, Autism Navigator. We have webinars that we offer regularly. You can click on webinars in our menu. We have courses for families and professionals. We have a free course called About Autism in Toddlers. It's free and it's our signature course. And we have over 100,000 people registered from, I think we're close to 200 countries. So there's clearly a global interest. And then we have other more advanced courses. We have family courses and family webinars as well. And then I don't want to forget, we have our Summer Training Institute. Kathy, you want to mention that is co-sponsored with FSU CARD.
Yes, that's great. So one thing that is a nice tradition here from the Autism Institute and CARD that we work on together is our Summer Training Institute on Autism. That is actually online this year, free June 18th through the 20th. So that is for all audiences, and it covers a much broader span of ages. So registration for that will be up on our websites. As Amy said, you can find it on autismnavigator.com, looking at the webinar tab.
So let me tell you what I hear, and you tell me where I'm wrong for the listening audience. It really sounds like you all really kind of work together. It depends on where I am and what's happening
Yep.
as to
Oh,
who I would
absolutely.
contact. But either way, I can get information on resources from CARD, or I can go to the Institute.
Absolutely.
Okay. All
And
right. All right.
I was just going to say that's why we formed the Institute to bring the projects together so we are working together. We're
Okay.
all really part of one big institute to reach families, and we work very closely together, staff from both all the different projects.
All right. Well, we're going to take a brief break right now, but we'll get back into talking about ASD. Just tuning in, program is 411 Teen, and this edition is The Inner Beat. We are talking about autism spectrum disorder. Joining me, and I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, I welcome again Dr. Amy Weatherby and Catherine Zinko. I want you all to tell me what is autism? What is the autism spectrum disorder? What does that include? What does that mean? You know, tell me in the listening audience so we have a working understanding of who, what, where is autism?
Great question. I'll go ahead and get started on that question. So we now call it autism spectrum disorder, ASD, but you can also call it autism for short. It's a developmental disability that's caused by differences in the brain or in brain development. People with autism have two core areas of impairment or deficits. The first is in social communication and social interaction. So difficulty learning to talk, difficulty learning to how to interact with people. They also can have unusual behaviors that we describe as restricted interests, though they may have very narrow interests on certain topics that they become really talented on. They also can show repetitive behaviors with their body, in their language, in their movements, in how they use objects. And their narrow interests then can lead to strengths, but they face deficits in learning to communicate and interact, which is really how we learn when we get to school and beyond, and the foundation for learning. So it can impact many aspects of development.
Well, I would think you said that, you know, the communication is a real, they may have some deficits there. And communication is a core of just, you know, being able to relate to one another. And if people don't have an understanding for those deficits, then they are misread.
Right. That's absolutely right. And a person with autism may also have difficulty understanding your communication, your nonverbal behaviors. Mm-hmm. So communication is verbal and nonverbal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And they may have difficulty with both.
Kathy, did you want to join in? I just kind of threw that in, but certainly want to hear from you too.
No, that I like that we clarified that. It's, and ironically, we think of communication as spoken word, but more of our messages that we are talking are nonverbal. And that is especially difficult for people on the spectrum to understand just those things you're supposed to know. So it can make communicating and misinterpretation pretty prevalent. So.
And, you know, with nonverbal communication, that's the first communication that occurs.
Absolutely.
You got it.
Yeah.
That's in the first year of life.
Right.
Right? Babies are learning to communicate.
Right.
And
right.
That's when the first signs of autism can start to appear.
Exactly. Exactly. At what point, when you say that's the first time, at what point do you, well, let's go, let me do go back. What are some of the behaviors that parents and pediatricians and caregivers need to be aware of? And by at that, what I'm trying to ask is, how do they know? They know that something may not be quite the way it should be.
Yeah.
Something may be a little bit awry. Because, you know, you got to know the development and you got to know the basics before you can know that there's something wrong, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm going to go ahead and jump in first on this.
Yeah, yes, Liz just so basically described everything that, you know, the premise of everything you've developed, Amy, so go for it.
So we've been doing research on this for probably close to 30 years on early communication development and then communication differences and delays and the path to either communication disorders, learning disabilities, or autism. And so you can... let me just start with the average age of diagnosis in our country is between 4 and 5 years. And that hasn't changed in more than a decade. Mm. So our work at the Autism Institute has been to try to study and then share information with the world on what are the earliest signs. We're able to diagnose autism often now between 9 and 18 months of age.
Mm.
9 is very early, but 18 months should be standard. There are tools and people just, both families and professionals need to learn what are the signs, and we have screening tools and try to get children diagnosed early. But the signs are very easy to miss.
Okay.
And so I want to just give a couple examples. We have a lot of resources at Baby Navigator. So parents can go to Baby Navigator, join, and can screen their child if they enter by 18 months. But the things to look for are the early communication development. So babies first communicate with gestures starting around 9 months of age. They use a give gesture. They use a push away. They turn their head away when they don't want something. And then they show objects to get your attention. Or they reach and then they learn to point. Those gestures are going to be delayed in children with autism as well as other developmental disorders. So those are the early signs, the delay in those early gestures. But we can also start to see the overly focused interest, narrower interest in children who are later diagnosed with autism, and repetitive behaviors are coming up. We actually have a checklist of the 16 early signs of autism that's available on Baby Navigator. You can actually get to it from both Autism Navigator and Baby Navigator. It's a lookbook. So one of the things we've done with our research, we've collected a really unparalleled library, if I say so myself, of videos of young children who we've followed. And so we have this wonderful set of videos from parents who gave us permission to educate the public on, and we also have pictures from that. So we have a lookbook, which is a picture book of the 16 early signs. We have a checklist that you can get to. You can actually go to Baby Navigator. You can just Google 16 early signs, get to Baby Navigator, and you can download it, the lookbook and the checklist to fill in. And then we have a lot of video resources. We have a 3-minute, can you spare 2 minutes? And we show you what it looks like. And you can get to that on Baby Navigator. And then we say, can you spare another minute? And we show you a child and see if you can then notice the early signs. So you need to be trained to look for them. Parents and professionals can be trained. Like everybody needs training to catch this earlier. We need to do far better than wait until children are 4 or 5, because then they completely miss the opportunity for early intervention.
And I would think the symptoms may change at that point, right?
Well, they're changing over time and actually behavior. So then when they're little, children the language may be delayed and the behaviors are coming in. And as they get older, the signs of autism actually interfere with learning. Mm-hmm. So they may get further behind as they're developing because they're not paying attention, they're not interacting, they're not learning in the social environments that they're in. And they may be overly focused on the things that are interesting to them, which is a good thing, but it can interfere with learning all the other stuff that babies and toddlers and preschoolers need to be learning. Okay.
And Amy, I'll just add on to that, Liz, to if we're waiting until the kids are already in school and we've missed all those opportunities and their language is falling behind and they're really not picking things up, the likelihood of challenging behaviors that may start to appear is much higher because now we're not giving them those foundational skills that we can help kind of shore up and catch up. And now they're in a classroom and completely overwhelmed and not knowing what it is they're supposed to pay attention to. And then their behaviors can be misunderstood or, you know, viewed as problematic. So we're really trying to prevent that from happening.
May I ask?
Well, I'm just going to throw in that children and adults with autism can gain skills and do better at any age.
Mm-hmm.
So there's things that can be done at any age to improve communication, interaction, challenging behaviors. But the earlier you start, the faster the progress is going to be because of brain development.
Mm-hmm.
But today is earlier than next week and next year. So right. We're getting started as soon as we can, what it's all about.
I ask about, what about the training of pediatricians? Because I have seen just in my own interaction that often the pediatrician is missing the signs, and I see kids that the pediatrician just said, oh, give them some time, they'll be okay. And so I wonder about that.
Yeah. And we've done a lot of work on training and working, collaborating with physicians, pediatricians, and family physicians. So we've developed a course with Autism Navigator called Autism Navigator for Primary Care for not only the doctors, nurses, but others who touch the general pediatric audience. So we have a course. We have small pieces of the course that people can get to. We've done studies and we've been able to reduce. So we work with a very large pediatric practice. We were able to reduce the age of referral from 36 months down to 20 months and with our training. As one example, we've done a number of studies. We also have a screening tool that's more sensitive than the more widely used screening tools that are available. So we have a lot of resources on both Autism Navigator and Baby Navigator to help train physicians. And in the state of Florida, I know the legislature each year is talking about this and working on new approaches to getting more training and in both screening, diagnosis, and getting children into services earlier.
Okay. What is the etiology or the cause of autism or autism spectrum disorder? I mean, because from my understanding, and you correct me if I'm wrong because we're going to elaborate, it doesn't seem to have a clear-cut cause. We're always looking for a cause, but I mean, there are some factors and I'm sure that you will share those with us, but so many times parents are always asking, well, what happened? What's the cause? Why? How did this occur? And it's,
usually a combination of things.
Yeah, but we do know quite a bit, actually. Okay. We know quite a bit. So one
has
of
it
the
changed? Well, excuse me, I want to ask, because when I was in school, you know, the picture that was painted, it seemed like it was always, the cause was the parents.
Yeah, that was when I was in school, too.
Okay, all right.
We have learned since then that is not the case at all. So really what we know is it's a neurodevelopmental disorder. So what that means is it affects the brain development. Mm-hmm. And so there are brain differences that have been measured, and we have a better idea on what parts of the brain. But what causes that? And so the primary cause that we know is genetic. And the reason we know this is that we've studied identical twins versus fraternal twins and siblings who are not twins. And what we find is that if one identical twin has it, the other one has not 100%, but kind of in the 70 to 80, 90% chance of also having it. So it's more than genetics, but genetics play a primary role, even if you don't know it's in your family. And it could be a mutation. It could be genetics that pop up and cross generations. But the genetic basis is primary. So we think about this gene-environment interaction is the cause.
Okay.
This combination of, and we're learning more and more, but one thing I'm going to just put this out here, that we know is that the vaccines do not cause it. There's been a lot of research on the vaccines.
Say that again and again and again.
And again and again and again. Yeah. And really, what we know is that the signs and the presence of autism is much before any vaccines are given. Right. So it's not the vaccines, but a lot of people think it is.
I know, and that's so why that's I said, say it again and again.
Yeah, that's a myth, but I know some people believe that. I've had a family say, well, how could my child get it? I didn't vaccinate them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, because the vaccines aren't the cause. Now, certainly any child can have a reaction to a vaccine, but that doesn't cause autism, but they can have a allergy or a reaction, so that it does exist.
When we talk about it seems like it's a relation. The genetics are the basis, and then there are environmental factors. And we talk about some of those environmental factors, and I think about, you know, even the stress during pregnancy or pollution, talking about some of the environmental triggers, because I think those are important, and I know you
all
do
of
too.
All those, what you're saying, are being studied and have some basis, but most of them are elevating the risk by a very small percentage.
Okay.
So, for example, premature children are at a higher risk. Mm-hmm. The general population is it's 1 in 36 is the prevalence estimate, so that's about 2.5%, a little higher than 2.5%. That's the general risk to everybody. If you are preemie, it's closer to 7%. So it's elevated. Another one that's fascinating to me is older fathers. That's been shown to be associated, again, a slightly elevated risk. So a lot of they've looked at the pregnancy and things going on. But also air pollution.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Yes.
Right? But again, it's a small elevated risk.
Okay.
So it's probably that it's this combination of risk factors that are making it happen. But the earlier we can get in when the brain has not yet fully developed, the more we can prevent some of the impact of the autism symptoms or differences on learning. And that's the real key of the early detection, if we can get in early.
And that's, that's the key. Yeah, Kathy.
I just wanted to follow up really quickly, Liz. So as I'm listening and participating in this conversation, what I hope the listeners heard is that anybody who tells you they know the exact cause of autism, they're wrong. So the science is not there yet. So please be cautious. If you encounter somebody who is claiming that they know the cause of autism and therefore you should do, you know, X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm.
But just to counter that, Kathy, we do know a lot about causes. So there is a lot of information out there. It's not in a little package that you can put a bow on, right?
Well, that's what I'm trying to say.
Combination. Which is why the signs are quite diverse. They look different in different people who have autism. Mm-hmm. We don't yet have subgroups that we really know what caused different groups, but we do see this common set of features that we now recognize as autism spectrum disorder that can be diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there particular risk factors that you could share that are associated with it? I mean, like neuroanatomical brain abnormalities. Do you mind? Would you all share some of that?
Yeah, it's more the part of the brain that's involved.
Okay.
I mean, it's possible that you can have a brain tumor, and that can contribute if it occurs very early in life. That's unusual. Usually we don't find any kind of a brain tumor, but we do see differences in the number of cells, the thickness of the layers of the cortex in different regions of the brain. There's the cortex, that's the outer part, the newer brain that controls talking and thinking and learning. And then there's the subcortex, the brain structures that are older that we share historically, right? That we share with other animals that are deeper in the brain. And so the involvement with autism is the cerebellum that sits behind the cortex, the brainstem, the thalamus, the part right at the top, and then going the limbic system, which controls emotion, and then the cortex that's around that. So the pattern is we see different patterns that are in MRIs, for example. Research has shown different myelination, the white stuff that you pick up, and the density of it in different parts of the brain.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts, and Kathy, I'll come back to you and see what you have to share. It's that time that I told you about. We need to take a brief break, but I'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen Inner Beat, and I am talking with Catherine Zenko with the Center for Autism and Related Disabilities and Dr. Amy Weatherby, Director of FSU Autism Institute. Kathy, I'd like to get your take on what we were talking about as far as the brain and abnormalities, and if you had anything that you wanted to add.
I think Amy covered it pretty thoroughly.
Okay.
The only other thing I would add is some of the research is showing us not just structural differences, but the connectivity pathways between certain areas of the brain, too, that we're starting to see some differences as well.
Okay.
Amy, would you elaborate?
Yeah, and then I even want to add to that. Right. So the different regions that I talked about are all connected to each other.
Yep.
And they mature and become more and more elaborate connections, more connections. So I don't want people to be scared by the notion that this is a brain disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of it as brain differences, but you know, the environment can impact the brain really across the lifespan,
could
just have a bigger impact earlier. So, you know, it's not that we can't make changes. Individuals with autism can learn at any age and compensate if there are parts, you know, the brain learns to accommodate for itself. If some skills aren't developing, then others are developing more or differently, or different parts of the brain can help take over. So it's not as scary as it sounds. And the key is helping to optimize the learning environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what our training that we have to offer is, to help families, professionals know, well, there are things we can do to improve quality of life and learning. Mm-hmm. And that's important, and that's available for people who have autism or children. And often the doctors are reluctant to bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we've learned is the families bring it up to their doctor. That may then lead to a fruitful conversation with your doctor about it. And we have the resources to help both learn, to help everybody. Someone bring it up. Don't just not talk about it.
Yeah. So what I hear is that autism spectrum disorder can manifest in very different ways in each person. I mean, that's why it's a spectrum or a variation. Is that right? I want the audience to understand that.
Absolutely,
it's not any
right.
one little thing. That's
right.
why it's
Correct.
On. That's why it's called spectrum,
yes,
meaning
absolutely.
Variation. For example, I mean, we talked about speech. And mm-hmm. some and I'm going to just use it briefly, autistic kids are nonverbal.
Correct.
Others have quite a proficient spoken language.
Yes.
Right? Am I correct there? So, and
yes.
You can see that.
Yeah.
Will you talk about the evolution? This is what I'm calling it, the evolution of the disorder. And by that, I'm talking about the symptoms that are identified.
Yeah.
You know, it's changed. Like Amy, you and I were saying that things have changed since we were in school, you know, because they were saying that, oh, the parents are the problem and this is happening and cold mothers and all this. So will you talk about how it's evolved?
Yeah. And those are myths and there's no truth.
That,
there's research
yes.
to show that is not at all the case. Actually, the families are the ones who can make the biggest difference in improving outcomes. I want to just start it and I'll turn it to Kathy. But I think that we want to think about that the landscape of autism is changing. So it used to be 1 in 2,500. It used mm-hmm. to be 1 in 500, like 50 years ago, 30 years ago. At that time, then the majority, 3/4 or more, also had a cognitive delay or deficit or an intellectual disability along with autism. Now in the 1 in 36, the majority do not have an intellectual disability. So about a third have autism with an intellectual disability. We also can have autism with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive disorder. We used to, before the most recent addition of the diagnostic manual, you could either be diagnosed with autism or ADHD. Now you can be diagnosed with both. And about 50% or more individuals on the spectrum also have signs of attention deficit hyperactive disorder. So we now understand things can co-occur. And then anxiety is another one that can co-occur. Anxiety can be a big part of the challenges faced by people with autism, and they can even have it as big as an anxiety disorder. Other people can have the anxiety disorder without the autism. So these things can co-occur, the landscape's changing, and now most individuals on the spectrum actually are pretty verbal,
mm-hmm.
Have quite mm-hmm. a bit of language, whereas, you know, 30 years ago when we were in school, not the case at all.
Right. Kathy, did you want to,
Kathy, want to add
anything?
Yeah, I think, Amy, you covered that really well, but I think it is really, the statistics to me are so fascinating that, you know, it was back in 1970, it was 1 in 2,500, and now in 2023, we're 1 in 36. So, you know, basically, if you have 36 friends, if you know 36 people, somebody in that circle, you will probably have met somebody on the autism spectrum. And as you mentioned earlier, Liz, it's a very broad spectrum, and the spectrum definition has evolved with each iteration of that diagnostic and statistical manual. So we do have people, like you said, who, you know, may not use speech to communicate. And then we have others whose vocabulary is better than mine, and then everywhere in between. And so it truly is quite a broad spectrum. And which is great, but it also, you know, there's a lot of things to learn about each individual person.
Yeah. And a lot of challenges that an individual can face across the lifespan. And even if you have a lot of language, you
right.
may have a lot of impairments interacting with people. You may struggle with anxiety and depression, difficulty making friends, difficulty getting a job.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, you know, the landscape's changing, but we need to improve outcomes in adults. And part of the way we do that is start when they're infants and toddlers. But we also need to offer improved services and support for across the lifespan to improve outcomes.
Who are the autistic individuals? And by that, I just want, you know, let's look at the demographics. I know when I was in school, you rarely saw people of color. Diagnosed with autism. You know, if they had some problems, they were, you know, mentally retarded, behavior disorders, but they weren't autistic. Now you do see more individuals of color. So what's going on? Why has that happened? I mean, have we just become more sophisticated in our diagnostic evaluations? Or why are we seeing this?
You know, there's many reasons, and a lot of it falls within what we call disparities, health disparities, mm-hmm. educational disparities. And so the CDC has studied the prevalence. Every couple of years, they have a new report. And with the most recent report, with the 1 in 36 prevalence estimate, now minorities are even with not with mainstream. So now we see relatively similar prevalence estimates, whites, blacks, Hispanics, and other minorities. Previously, they were missing the minorities. So really, a lot of the increase in the CDC reporting is the increase in minorities who were missed. And part of the missing is, you know, we jump to a conclusion. Oh, if it's an individual with minority, a child who's a minority, oh, it's a behavior problem. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And we just don't even think about autism. And that's the disparity. And we need to do better.
We're inching towards some progress, but there's still a lot to be made. Yeah. So I think it's also this disparities has been in the research not long enough, but we've definitely, it's something we're talking about and people are more aware of it and really focusing on that. So I do believe we're moving in the right direction. We're just not necessarily there yet.
Minorities, low-income families, rural families are diagnosed 1 to 3 years later. And that can mean just missing the opportunity for early intervention.
Mm-hmm. And the lack of resources.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes. The lack of. Can autism be prevented?
A great question. I think it's helpful to think about autism symptoms or diagnostic features or characteristics. And so the different characteristics can be improved. We don't have a cure for autism. And I don't think we want a cure for autism because autism also brings many strengths. Sure. We want to improve the challenges, the weaknesses. So I think it's more thinking about and what are the interventions that are targeted to improve communication and social interaction, to improve challenging behaviors. If a child has ADHD or ADD, attention deficit disorder, with autism, the autism then is harder to deal with. And so improving some of the attentional differences. So we now think about a menu of services for the different features. And then we want to promote their strengths because that, you know, there's many individuals who are very famous who have autism and are contributing immensely, and ones who are not so famous, you know, who are or can contribute immensely to society. So I don't think we want to get rid of autism, but we want to help improve the quality of life and the outcomes and the contributions of people with autism.
You know, it is not something we're looking to get rid of. It is something we're looking to, like Amy said, build up strengths where they are there and then do whatever we can to help build up any areas that may need extra support. So that those post-secondary and, you know, young adulthood and into adulthood, those outcomes are successful.
Well, what does a thorough diagnostic process involve? I would think of it, because I would think just talking with you all, that it's going to be a core of behaviors, you know, that may alert one to the possibility is that something is wrong, a sort of dimensional approach.
Well, the good news is we have gold standard diagnostic tools.
Okay.
So they're standardized. They're a combination of gathering information from the parent, if it's an older individual, from the individual who may have autism. And we also have observational diagnostic tools that are well validated. The bad news is there's very long wait lists. They're expensive, can be expensive, and there's very long wait lists. So what we hope to offer is information on what the signs and symptoms look like. So everybody can be aware. You can get started before you have a diagnosis and then get on the path toward diagnosis. The public schools are supposed to offer a or a determination of eligibility based on autism. The early intervention system doesn't necessarily diagnose, but they should offer help for these kinds of diagnostic features. So the system should be there to help. There's a lot of improvement needed. What's so important is to get going, to get some help, and not, you know, there was an article in the UK, 4-year wait list. In Canada, oh, there's often 2-year wait list. In the United States, there's often a wait list as well. And then we have a lot of diagnosticians who are not adequately trained, and they're not using valid diagnostic tools. So we have problems with diagnosis, but we still want to get going, because even if your child isn't diagnosed, but they have some of these features, the treatments that we have to offer, their behavioral treatments, educational treatments, can benefit a lot of children, adults, to improve their ability to learn, to communicate, to interact. And really the key in life is to, when you're ready to get out of school, be able to have a job. And the research shows if you, the adults with autism who are doing the best are ones that get out of the house, go to a job, whether they're paid or volunteer, at least 10 hours a week.
Yep.
And so that's what we want to keep our eye on: quality of life, ability to, as you grow up, get through schooling, get a job. And then hopefully that builds to, for, you know, a 40-hour and a competitive salary.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm just going to piggyback on that. A lot of times where we can, our adults are the most successful, are those who have a team around them that know to take a look at what are those special interest areas. That's a characteristic of autism. What are some of those strengths? And can we translate that into a job or an opportunity so that we're utilizing their strengths, but also their interests? Because, you know, those of us who are, have the ability to have a job that we like, are quality of life is typically a lot better. So we want to make sure that we are capitalizing on strengths and paying attention to those interest areas and getting creative on how can we apply that to finding the right fit for either, you know, a paid or volunteer job, something meaningful, at least, as Amy said, 10 hours a week out of the house.
Okay. So what I hear is there is no cure. Autism lasts throughout a lifetime. And the treatment can vary. I mean, it could be therapeutic and educational and biomedical and dietary. It just, you know, it varies, is what I'm hearing from you. Is that correct?
Yeah, but there's also evidence. There's an evidence base. So there's research on what treatments are effective, and there's research on treatments that don't make a difference, and then ones that do harm. So we do need to at least help provide information to families on the treatments that have evidence that are the good things to be doing, and be careful about some of the ones that are not so good to do or are even potentially dangerous.
You want to add?
And with social media today, and everybody can put out information, it's really important to know where to go to find out what are those treatments that are backed by evidence. And our colleagues, some colleagues up at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, have an entire database website that lists all the evidence-based practices out there that have proven data. So we want our listeners to be sure to be good consumers and responsible customers and take a look at what's the research behind this before I step into it.
Yeah.
Well, we have 2 minutes remaining, and I want to ask if you have any closing words of wisdom that you would like to share with the listening audience.
Well, Liz, I'd just like to start out by inviting everybody to join us on April 21st. At the FSU Soccer Complex, we are having a large community event. It's called Kicking It for Autism with the FSU soccer team and coaches, all ages, all abilities, disability or not. I know that's probably one of our favorite events of the year. There's information right on our homepage on fsucard.com. And then, as I mentioned earlier, our Summer Training Institute on Autism is June 18th through the 20th, where we will have some very interesting speakers talking on a variety of topics for various ages along the lifespan of people on the spectrum.
Thinking about the needs of professionals and families, you know, we see these extreme characters that are in the media, from Rain Man to Forrest Gump, you know, way back, and now we have what the good doctor and kind of these extreme characters. The reality is most people with autism are not that like those characters at all, share a few features, but the nitty-gritty day-to-day life of a person with autism can be challenging, and for the family raising them. And so we want to make sure that families and individuals are comfortable speaking out, reach out to us. We're here to help or connect you with help. And you're playing the most important role to get that help.
Many thanks to my listening audience. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at wfsu.org.